the fabric of the universe that we all know and love, gravitational waves. Because gravitational waves allow us to test general relativity, see whether it's correct. But also, they're wonderful messengers for those of us who want to do things besides just test general relativity, at carrying information from the distant universe to us, because they're not impeded. Those of you out in the audience at home probably have noticed there's a shadow here. That is because light does not go through this hockey stick. You can see me, you can't see through the center of the Earth, but gravitational waves, though hard to make, couple weakly to everything and carry information about energetic processes far away to us. So what we want to do with gravitational wave detectors in the near future is use them not just to be able to see these merging binaries and say that there are gravitational waves, but to make a census of the binaries that are out there and say, oh, look, here's one binary with one mass, here's a binary neutron star, here's a couple binary black holes that have different masses and they have different spins. And this turns out to be an incredibly useful and powerful thing, because then we can say, well, here's how many they are, here's the different types, we can understand what made them. And this is a well-studied problem in astronomy. To give you an example, there are binary neutron stars in the Milky Way that you find by, until very recently, primarily found by radio telescopes, although that has just changed. And you know how your radio telescope works. And so you know you have seen, let's say, one merging binary from Earth in the Milky Way. This is a cartoon. And because you know how sensitive your detector is, and you know about other pulsars scattered throughout the Milky Way that you do see, you can infer how likely it would have been for you to see a randomly distributed neutron star binary in the Milky Way, and infer from the one or two, or in this case, one, two, three, four, five, how many binaries are out there like any one of these that you've seen. This is a plot of the log of the birth rate. This is a PDF. For each one of the binary merging neutron stars that we see, given in different colors that one observation, what you would infer for the birth rate of systems exactly like that. And adding them all up, you get the overall composite birth rate for all merging binary neutron stars in the Milky Way. So we've gone from understanding our network, counting the number of sources, to being able to make a prediction for how many are really being born in the universe. And then we take this prediction and we can compare with our understanding of how stars form in the Milky Way. Now, the problem that we immediately run into if we don't use gravitational waves is we don't know of any black hole binaries because they don't emit light. We know of black holes in binaries, but not black hole binaries, not black hole neutron star binaries, because we wouldn't see them. So we can't do this process without gravitational waves. And we have to make recourse to theory. What theory? Well, we have models for how stars form from gas, what fraction of stars form in binaries, how stars evolve, and we use this to make predictions. So people have done these predictions in the past, and Mikhail Dominik and Chris Belchinsky are running some revised predictions recently. You can read about it in this paper here, that suggests that perhaps the calculations we did in the past did not take into account all the degrees of freedom that we probably should have. Because what we did in the past, everyone did, is assume the universe is mostly like the Milky Way. Because a lot of star formation occurs on our light cone in roughly similar star forming conditions, so why should things be different? And yes, there's occasionally peculiar types of star formation on our past light cone, but it's relatively rare. And as long as that it's relatively rare, but it doesn't overproduce sources, that's fine. We can ignore irrelevant things if they stay irrelevant. However, if that irrelevant thing that we ignore happens to be very significant, for example, like this, then it's not a good idea to have ignored it. So what is this plot, and why does this suggest that it was a bad idea to ignore it? So this is assuming star formation, the entire universe of star formation is now going to be, we're going to assume it's not just like our galaxy, we're going to allow it to occur in other types of conditions, other types of metallicities. metallicity is the fraction of things that are hydrogen and helium. When you have more of these, you change the opacity of gas in stars, and this can affect stellar pollution in ways that I'll go into in detail momentarily. And here is the log of the event rate per year. So we've made a simple model for an initial LIGO detection volume for binary compact objects. And so this circle here shows the range of predictions not including, that we've done before. This also includes things that don't include just binaries, allows for dynamical interactions, and this spans several orders of magnitude. So we thought we were safe. You know, this is a very conservative range, you would think. However, you can see, look at the full blue points here, that if you were to change the metallicity from solar to slightly subsolar and slightly subsolar, if you form all stars at low metallicity, you get a large number of predicted events. Now, it's certainly true that not all stars are forming at subsolar metallicity. We can go out and see the stars in the universe. But this is a rate per year for a single initial LIGO detector with a 15 megaparsec double neutron star range. If everything forms, so this is a proof of principle saying if all star formation occurred at this metallicity, then we would see a lot of events. So then the idea is basically we have to average them. How much star formation occurs here? And how much star formation occurs here. And this is under one set of assumptions, and if you change the assumptions, we'll get different answers. But yes, if by not including this, a minuscule fraction of this can overwhelm this. This is also particularly important because binary compact objects, gravitational radiation isn't weak. If you put a binary slightly past the maximum separation needed for gravitational radiation to the maximum separation that allows gravitational radiation to drive them to merger, the merger time grows rapidly versus a large power of separation. And therefore, looking at it the other way around, binary black holes in particular, if they're going to merge, they tend to merge after very long delays. Gravitational radiation just barely gets them to the finish line. And so this is a plot versus the assuming all stars form at t equals zero. The plot basically the Green's function, the fraction of binary black hole binaries that merge as a function of the log of time. And this fraction is very small and grows as a low power law until late time stage of the universe. And most of the stuff that we will see comes after very long delays. And these curves are different models. You can see they make slightly different predictions. Yeah?
So the reason the low velocity produces more mergers is that they tend to produce heavier things, have a hard time
So we're not going into the, we're not changing the IMF. I'll get into what we're changing in a moment. But basically, all we're doing is two things. We're changing how big the black holes are, so we can see them farther away. And I'm spoiling my punchline. And we're changing a certain feature of binary evolution, which allows you to bring them closer together without merging. So it allows them to survive and get brought close together. They're heavier, they have more inertia, they're less affected by supernova kicks. And but most critically, they're big. And if you have a much bigger black
hole, they have the same IMF, they lose less of it in
there. And they're still a lot less. And so the range goes to the cube, so it's a dramatic difference. And if you go to the paper that's set on the first side, you can see the difference in the predicted posterior mass distributions. And you know, you basically have to average over the cube of the mass. So that your detection rate goes as the
I didn't realize you were going to.
Yeah, I mean, this goes like, and then you sum over all the masses. Unless it's actually, and so if there's a small fraction that have high mass, then it can overwhelm the low mass things that are more numerous. So the reason the long delay time is important is because anything that's merging now was actually formed a long time ago. And a long time ago had fewer generations of stars and it's higher metallicity naturally. So at a minimum, knowing that there's a long merger time, we ought to have used higher metallicity, ought to have used lower metallicity in doing the calculations that we did. And so we need to put in lower metallicity star formation at a minimum just to account for the fact that these things were born in an epoch of lower metallicity. Why is there an epoch of lower metallicity? Because stars process gas, and they convert it from hydrogen into heavier elements, and they eject that out into the area around it, and this gets born to another generation of stars, and so on and so forth. And that's great. And so the naive thing to do would be to say, all right, at every point in time in the past, there's a characteristic metallicity as a function of time, and this just grows. But that's not true either. Remember, this is a really strong bias towards low metallicity. So if ever any low metallicity star formation occurs anywhere, we have to make sure we include it. If we don't, then we're underestimating it by a substantial proportion. And if you look at the formation of structure, the way that galaxies capture subhalos, this is a plot versus redshift, and I don't have the, this is a redshift 5, 10, 15, 20. This is an example of the formation of the halo versus the, I have another slide where I fixed this, I didn't fix this. This is the log of the metallicity, and relative to solar. You can see the colors of the relative amounts of mass here, that you start out capturing at high redshift, small halos, well, the color is dark, of low metallicity, and you gradually build up structure. But you'll note that it's not a delta function. There's not a path, there's a range. And remember, if I just go a little bit this way, here you're capturing a stream at late time, if I just go a little bit this way, in this direction, this is saying that this galaxy has a metallicity distribution internally. This fraction will contribute much more than this fraction up here, just in this little range. So it's critical to model not just the evolution of metallicity with time, and not just the distribution of metallicity between galaxies, because not all galaxies are the same either, but also to model the structure within galaxies.
Could I ask just two simple questions?
Yes.
What's the line-like feature at high redshift?
This is primordial. This is the primordial. This is what they're assuming for basically the first generation of stars, and then they pop up into here.
And then the next one is: there are a lot of empty white spaces there, or is that just because this was some sort of Monte Carlo business?
Yeah, this is basically.
Especially up near Z of zero.
At near zero, you mean here? But the fact that it just follows in here. Yeah, some of these are white and you can't see them, so that's actually filled in. I apologize. This is not the best. There's another version of this that's slightly better, and I can point you to the. Oh yeah, that's the original paper there, so we can go through that if you'd like. So, this isn't a LIGO talk. I'm not speaking on behalf of LIGO collaboration. I have my astrophysicist hat on, and I can mention that there are people in this room, however, who can speak with their LIGO hat on, and they can publish papers pointing out that existing upper limits are pretty good and can see out to a reasonable range, comparable to the sort of predictions that we would make. I mean, you saw on the first slide, we were predicting for a very naive model of initial LIGO that you should see something. Turning this around, you can say, a certain person in this room can say, that we are wrong by doing a search and publishing a paper. And so that's great. I like to be proved wrong because it's a test. It's better to test and look than not test. So that was my outline, in particular my motivation, that why it's important to include low metallicity star formation. You have already spoiled my punchline for part two. Why are you so sensitive to low metallicity star formation? I briefly commented that there is a metallicity distribution in the star formation universe. And then I'm going to talk briefly about how second and particularly third generation detectors and short gamma ray bursts provide other tests to see whether or not to disentangle the contribution of low metallicity from high metallicity, from regular star formation. Because basically, to this point, all I've told you is the number goes up and down. But the number can go up and down for a bunch of reasons. Yes?
I was going to say, in full disclosure of the previous statement, we have limits. I think it's kind of still marginal, right? Because mm-hmm. it turns out that the S5 that we're constraining. Okay. Because I think it turns out that the S5 high mass search, although great anti-parallel folks, probably didn't quite make the same sensitivity that your sort of model of the rates would be. There's a factor with
the Bullock
much factor there.
I haven't talked about the Bullock at all. Right, the one that I quoted actually would be above.
Actually, okay.
Yeah. So
I'm
talking about the no. There's another number I can get that's even higher. If I really want to do crazy things, I can do crazy things. So don't doubt me.
Is there a tension between your model and their?
No, our model has a lot of knobs. So the tension is basically that we have low metallicity star formation ought to produce a lot of compact binaries. This is degenerate with other things, and that basically, for example, the high mass IMF, how many stars form compact binaries overall? And what we really want to do is break that degeneracy. It's good for LIGO because it means there's probably more detections because there's a new channel that we hadn't included, low metallicity star formation, that I'm going to talk about. But the problem is then that we just are predicting more sources, but are they the same size of sources? Can we distinguish this effect from other effects and do science with the population that we see? And in fact, the population of, I'm going to spoil another punchline, the population of compact binaries that you get from low metallicity is different. The whole point, reason why you see more, is they're more massive. You can tell that apart. And with third generation detectors, completely spoiling my point, you'll be able to measure the mass distribution as function of time.
Does it also have an impact on the possible eccentricities we have in the binary
that form? Eccentricities in the binary that form. For the black hole binaries that you would form, at the same mass?
Yeah.
So for example, if you're forming your massive black hole binaries from solar metallicity in globular clusters versus low metallicity in binary evolution, the low metallicity binary evolution we think have prompt collapse, so they had a low eccentricity, whereas at the same mass, solar metallicity stuff forming in globular clusters would have more eccentricity, but it's still a very small.
This is even thrust, but some groups are beginning to seriously consider the effect of eccentricities in the waveforms, and they come up with very nice pictures, and we're very excited to see these things, but now I'd like to get on the astrophysics side.
It's very hard to measure eccentricity in band. You have to do something very, there are ways to do it, but by the time right before merger, you've gone through so many scales of separation that you've basically eaten away most of the eccentricity. So you basically have to put it into an eccentricity that's that high. It's hard.
Initially, the eccentricities when they form, even I think the last thing I heard was like 0.5, 0.3. They claim that there will be significant.
What is the definition of significant?
Significant to make the detection, to make them significantly different when you have to be deployed. That's what they claim. I'm not necessarily subscribe to that, but
I've heard the scenario. I think the scenario
is Ryan's.
Is that you have like three-body system that does that mechanism of drives up the eccentricity somehow.
Oh, and yeah.
But
yeah,
maybe
and.
Maybe this is not
the I think I might have missed seeing that paper go by. We can track that down.
Yeah, that's one of the chances.
Yeah, people have talked about this before. Okay, yeah, we can talk about this at the end. But I've seen people have done this before in globular clusters. The COSI mechanism is not a new mechanism. And even when you include it, you really have to kick. You basically have to do something like a COSI three-body body thing in a really dense, highly high-velocity cluster. So you'd need a nuclear star cluster around a massive black hole. So this is Ryan O'Leary stuff. And you can do it, but you have to make aggressive assumptions, in my opinion. And if there's a new paper that has another calculation that's doing COSI, I don't think.
Why not take it out?
Okay. Like then Hamilton, Miller, do they do COSI as well? Or is that just scattering from? Well, we can track this down at the end. The poor people at home can be not subject to doing this.
But I guess there's two separate things. There's
mm-hmm.
whether you
is left affects what? My claim is that the only way to have eccentricity of 0.5 in LIGO is to have eccentricity of 0.999 at a slightly larger separation, where slightly, astrophysically.
No, right, so the argument is that when it gets to LIGO band,
mm-hmm.
you don't have 0.5, you have much more than that, but that's enough to produce a observable effect.
For an advanced LIGO, is this like an ET where you have a really good low frequency sensitivity? Because usually you don't pick up enough SNR early on to be able to distinguish that sort of phasing. It's very, we can barely pick up spin effects in double neutrons. You can, And spin is a very strong effect.
Well,
for
I mean, we can check later.
Okay. So another astrophysics slide. So why does metallicity matter? That's because stars evolve, and as they evolve, they get bigger. And if they can occasionally, as they get bigger, if you have another star nearby, get so big that some of that material gets stripped off onto their companion, and then they explode and get kicked by the asymmetric supernova explosion. Some material gets pulled onto back onto the star that blew up, and if it's expanding too rapidly, you can go through what's known as a common envelope phase, where this star ends up, this expands so rapidly that this star basically is spiraling in through the loosely bound envelope, ejects it off to infinity, and you're left with two tightly bound objects. Now, the reason why these interactions are important is basically because in order to get these things to merge, they have to be really close, and in order to get really close, really close is much smaller than the radius of a giant star. So it's impossible to avoid mass transfer in when making these things. And that's important because the separation that you get depends on the degree to which you're pulled in depends on how much, in some sense, inertia you have. It's easier to pull things in if you have less mass bodies that you have to pull in. And so you end up, it's important, metallicity affects the change in separation to mass transfer because low metallicity stars lose less mass through evolution. So this, just look at the blue curves here. So this is a plot versus the progenitor mass of an isolated star and the final mass of the compact remnant at low metallicity and solar metallicity. And the main thing you should notice is just the scale. At low metallicity, you can make much more massive compact objects than you can at solar metallicity because you have a much lower opacity with pure hydrogen, and you basically don't blow off as much material. And that's important. You get bigger black holes that you can see farther away. It also modifies how your stars evolve. At solar metallicity, you'll go through a rapid expansion phase, and either your binary is out here, at which point you, as moving along in time, massive star companion, nothing happens, and then we never come to merger, or you're in here, sailing along, and you interact in this phase. Now, this phase is a peculiar phase, and that very often leads to unstable mass transfer and common envelope evolution. And for massive stars in particular, it's possible, we don't know, but no one can do the hydro, that these will be driven all the way to merger. So if you interact in here at all, you're gone. We have a flag that says either this happens or it doesn't. If you interact up here, you can also have mass transfer, and this is more stable and regular. Whereas for low metallicity, it's different. You're much more likely to interact in this nice, safe region, not this horrible red region.
Sorry, I'm just slowly taking
them.
So there's something, the red region is some period where, this is the red giant. This is where it's
pretty
our
giant. And so they're expanding to the giant branch very rapidly. And for massive stars, they don't have a low result for a envelope boundary. And so what can happen, we don't know, is that during the common envelope phase, the common envelope is defined where you strip off the envelope. If you don't know where the envelope is, maybe you merge instead of going through this phase, you just go all the way in. So this is something that people who do hydro should fix, and I think people will. But right now we have very simple algorithms that basically say there's a core, there's an envelope, and we strip it off, which seems consistent. But if you can't find a core envelope, then maybe that's...
There haven't been hydro simulations of common envelope?
There have been. So Ron Tam has done some, with Tam Ricker and Tam. I've done some. And there is also Nordhaus is going to do some at Rochester.
So what are the open questions for
common envelope?
Yeah.
Anything, basically. Can it be done for a long period of time? How does the equation... So for example, when you check the envelope, this is ionized here and neutral gas here. There's a flag people sit that says ionization matters, ionization doesn't matter. Probably often being faked during important part. Most of the binding energy is lost in here. So maybe it doesn't actually, the ionization, doesn't matter. But it has a lot of energy associated with going from ions to neutrons. So it would be nice to do hydro with radiative transfer and see whether or not,
But the simple hydro problem has been done. People have shown the ejection of the
ejection.
Just for not even a black hole common envelope situation.
That's
just a stellar.
I've seen some calculations by Ron. I haven't seen a full movie that goes through it because these things last for a long time. So just the dynamical time.
Ron, who's Ron?
Ron Tan. And so these things take a long time.
But the derivative is easy to estimate, right? So you can tell if it's shrinking.
Yeah, you can tell it's shrinking because you're
mass and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it does what you expect. Right?
Yeah. And Ron worked a long time with simulation after simulation back in the old days. All right. So now you understand why metallicity matters, most critically for gravitational wave sources, and particularly binary black holes because it changes mass. So in this average, for the number of sources you detect, the sum over all sources times of the intrinsic rate of the sources times the volume to which you can see them. The volume goes roughly as the mass, as the distance cube goes to the mass cube, different with cosmology, but let's not go there. And so the contribution from more massive sources is very important. And also you get more binaries surviving evolution. Is there a block? I actually don't have one running. So how am I talking? I actually do not have a clock running, so.
You have 30 seconds.
Oh, good. Perfect. All right. So then I will just go through this slide. So that's great. So that will allow us to say, well, metallicity matters. We have a theoretical explanation for what I showed you in that first slide. And so therefore, I can turn it off. And by turning it on, I can say it's going to affect our answer by this much, right? Well, that's unfortunately not how we do things, because once it's true that I can turn on that the contribution from low metallicity and include it in the passivity of star formation, I have a bunch of other knobs that I can turn to. And not just that common envelope flag thing I told you about, but also how much mass is accreted on the black hole during a common envelope phase, which we don't know. We could also modify the ion mass of low metallicity, which we're not going to do. We could change how we model the binding energy of the envelope to be more physical. This has actually become less of an uncertainty now because people have tabulated this. But there are a lot of features of binary evolution that are basically tables of numbers, because you have to do it fast. You have to do it for a large number of binaries. And while you normalize it to the best physics that you have, there's a lot of other possible physics, rotation, supernova kicks, if you assume that they could possibly act on the black hole horizon, that might change how what the answer is. So right now, what I'm going to show you is one point, is the table from this plot, the plot from this paper, where just to illustrate the point that if you have solar metallicity star formation, it's not just binary black holes that get enhanced, it's other formation channels relative to low metallicity star formation. Compared, this is apples to apples, this is oranges to oranges. So we're switching off whether or not things are forced to merge during common envelope phase or not. And you can see that if you force them to merge, you can, in this case here, at solar metallicity, if you're saying anything interacts in this common envelope phase and the Hertzsprung gap merges, you basically don't form binary black holes. This is Chris's paper a couple years ago. But at low metallicity, because the Hertzsprung gap phase, you expand to a giant and then more slowly, and you can interact in the second phase, more stable mass transfer, you can have a massive increase, relatively speaking, in the number of black hole binaries. You also get a more surviving black hole neutron star binary, comparing apples to apples. If you have just slightly lower metals, which you can see in the nearby universe.
Wait,
don't
the numbers change in the total?
In this? This is an average.
When they look at the last row.
Did they not? Did he not add them up right? Which numbers came?
So I just compared for the ones in parentheses, so I got 14, 16, and 15, so it doesn't seem to be a huge effect.
In this case? This is the total number of detections, but you'll have many more binary. So in this case, the total number of objects that you detect would not increase. If you detect many, many more many, many more black hole ions. I mean, in this case, the number is dominated by double neutron stars, so this is 14. And here, you're having a more chance of seeing them as double neutron stars, black hole neutron stars, or double black holes. So rather than see only double neutron stars, you see a range of things.
So what you're doing is you're reducing the binding of stars to create more black holes.
Yeah. I mean, and that makes sense, right? If you have low metallicity, you're forming more massive compact objects. So things that would be double neutron stars are now higher black holes. And that's that.
You form higher mass. You have lower metallicity, you form higher mass
objects. Yes. And so, and you can see that the admixture really dominates. And it's also true if you allow things to survive. And in that case, the rate can get quite high. Now, in previous calculations, yes?
So back to black and white, so as far as protections, I guess, you know, more black hole protections would go up, as you can see further.
Yes.
But other thing, though, that, so what's the motivation of the 50%, 50%? Is that just to show?
Made it up.
Just made up?
Completely made up.
And
it's an illustration. Yeah, just to point out that there's probably an admixture. This actually occurs relatively often in a local universe. This is not a crazy number. And so even for a reasonable admixture, this vastly dominates.
In reality, it's some sort of distribution.
And the low metallicity stuff, as you saw on the first slide, this preliminary calculation, if you have even a small amount of it, it can make a huge difference. Once you're below 10 to the minus 3, it's not going to change as much. But there's a strong power law in the event rate of function. So it's really important to get this distribution right as well as you can. And we didn't do that before. When we do these calculations and you look at papers by me, we never included that. We included time-dependent star formation. We had two metallicity events. We did try different metallicities, but not that different from solar. And we had higher rates, but we didn't really do a distribution. We just had two bins. We allowed there to be some jitter in the two. But we didn't thoroughly explore any of these calculations before. So if you go and look at predictions for what the advanced LIGO network might see based on a simple model, pure theorist model of what these detector networks would work like, you get predictions for 10 to 100. This is the log of the predicted detect event rate. This is the probability of having that event rate or lower. There's a good chance that you'll have that number or higher. There's a good chance of having, well, reasonable chance of having 10 to 100 times 3.
So now this is holding the star formation rate equal in both regions, right?
In what?
In the high and low metallicity.
No. This is a time dependent. So what we've done in this calculation is we have a total model for the star formation of the universe, and we needed to split it in two to call what some fraction of it elliptical and some fraction of it spiral. So we picked our favorite model and we blessed it, and we said this is how star formation occurs. This is spiral, all star formation is solar, and it's roughly a constant radius function of time, and this fraction that peaks at a redshift of 2 or so is the low metallicity star formation. Or at least a different metallicity star formation. We considered low and high. And that peaks at earlier times. So we did include both. And we included a jitter in this as well. So we jittered these metallicities, but not enough. Because some higher galaxies have high metallicity, because they process a lot of generation of stars. But that was not enough, because we know that this model, this two-bin model, was not enough. Because there's a secular trend in metallicity with time. Just empirically, you can go back and look at stars at the versus redshift. And admittedly, some uncertainty. These are different people getting different answers. But physically, you expect, and observationally, you sort of see there's a trend that if you look back in the earlier universe, the metallicity of stars in that instance is lower. It has to be. But it's reassuring. That's what we see. And we can also factor in the fact that within galaxies, there is a distribution of metallicities. And you can calculate this theoretically through standard galactic chemical evolution, or it's the tail-tail models. And between galaxies, there's a distribution of metallicity. This is an observations of nearby galaxies, function of the log of mass, and again, it's the log of metallicity. And there's something that's now famous called the mass-metallicity relation. Low-mass galaxies have low metallicity. They're basically closer to primordial than heaven. And high-mass galaxies have processed many more generations of stars. This means that these galaxies, these faint galaxies down here, are much, if we take all these other things at face value, dwarf galaxies are much more likely to produce the sort of merging compact remnants that we know and love. And so we're going to put those all together to try to make a prediction. Now, we can make predictions, so that's great, but these predictions start to point to very high detection rates, and they depend very sensitively on those numbers. And there are different ways that you can do this. This is actually present-day metallicity. So as you make the answer even slightly wrong, you can get a very different answer. So you want to compare with observations to say, am I completely making this up? So are there any observations which suggest that there are a lot of emerging high-mass binaries in a low-metallicity environment? And Tomek and Chris and the third author, the next year's number, who I don't remember, have inferred that these two X-ray binaries, this is a black hole and a massive star, they infer that this massive star is low-metallicity, and it will not evolve and lose all its mass. It will stay a really high-mass star, and it will evolve into a merging black hole binary. And if you take that at face value, both of those two statements, the mass is not going to go down, and it will evolve into a merging binary, then based on the selection effects of your X-ray survey, taking the X-ray astronomy on faith, then you end up with a prediction. I know how sensitive my detector is, just like slide number one. So I can say, given that I see one, I know the birth rate of these things has to be something. And in this case, I also know what the final mass is. So I can say, I can create a volume to which I would see this with LIGO. And this is their interpretation of what the LIGO detection volume would be. And predict how many sources LIGO would see, given that I've seen this binary. And that number is large. And corresponds to a volumetric event rate. So you can compare that with what Chad pointed out before. And that was the point that Chad was making in his earlier question. There is still some movement there. But that means, so it's not crazy to say that there's a contribution from low metallicity. It's not crazy to say that that these things could occur. And to this point, observations have not ruled them out yet, but they could soon. But this is just the overall number, which depends very sensitively on metallicity. So what you also want to ask is, which is great, I mean, we'll have more sources, more things to do stuff with. But what you also want to ask is, we've made a prediction, and it changes the total number of merging binaries. But you could imagine doing other things, like basically say, well, I bet that really high-mass stars form more often than you think. And you can't guess that because really high-mass stars live for a very short time. It's difficult to measure the high-mass INF, particularly in the early universe. Or basically, other things that basically change the scale. If you change the normalization, you get more. So what you want to do is have some other predictions. And another prediction is there's going to be high-mass binaries. But there are other ways, we talked about this earlier, to make high-mass binaries. So what prediction does this sort of thing make that's more distinctive? Well, there's probably a trend with time, right? Things in the early universe had one metallicity, and things in the late universe had a different metallicity. So there'll be a trend in the characteristic black hole mass with time. Modulo things about involving a long delay between birth and merger. So second, and particularly third generation detectors, second might not have enough detections. Although they might, if you believe the highest possible resolution we can see, second generation detectors will have a whole long sort of mass. But third generation gravitational wave detectors we'll be able to see double neutron stars to high redshift. This is the log of redshift. This is 3-ish. And merging black hole binaries to much farther away. And so you'll have a large number of events that you can see, in this case, 10 to 5 double neutron stars. And they'll reach back to the peak star formation rate cloud unfortunately the log of the star formation rate. It's a function of time, here the redshift units. Star formation rate is peaking here, that's why the rate is going up. And stars born here, they form merging binaries, they merge after some time, and that time is relatively short. So the double neutron star peak traces the star formation rate. But during this entire epoch, you're processing stars into gas and metals. The stars are blowing up and recycling the gas, so the metals are evolving. Now, the neutron stars are neutron stars are neutron stars. Changing, you're not going to change the nuclear equation state, but you can change the black hole mass. And we can measure that in black hole neutron star binaries, black hole binaries. And assuming we can get reliable redshift spinning, we might be able to make a statement for how the mass is evolving redshift. So what else might you do? Well, the only other obvious direction to go is to look at black hole neutron star binaries and say, well, black hole neutron star binaries might have an electromagnetic counterpart. I can see the galaxy the electromagnetic counterpart is in. I could test, look, I can look at the galaxy and say, does this galaxy have limitlessity? Let's say. That seems like an idea that you might want to pursue. It isn't quite as straightforward as that for reasons that I'm going to go into momentarily. But why is there an electromagnetic counterpart and what would this counterpart look like? In fact, we think we already see them. We think that if you have a merging compact binary, it emits a lot of its gravitational binding energy in something. People in this room can tell you what their opinion on something is, and produce what's known as a short gamma ray burst, which people think are mergers because sometimes they're offset from their host galaxy. And the only way that you can get that to happen, without doing something odd, is you assume that the supernova kick that sends this binary inward into a tight orbit sends you careening across the room, conservation of momentum, and forces you away. So that's one of the primary reasons why people believe a merger model is because you see these offsets. So there are these kicks. So let's assume that you're believing a merger model for the origin of short gamma ray bursts. What would you predict? Well, if you believe that low metallicity star formation massively overproduces black hole neutron star binaries, you might expect that gamma ray bursts would preferentially be in low metallicity galaxies. That seems like an obvious conclusion. And you can test that because we have gamma ray bursts that we have seen. Ido Berger can tell you, I can go and look at the host galaxies of different short gamma ray bursts. And this is a plot of the, basically, in some sense, the mass of the galaxy. In this is the sign for mass, and versus the metallicity of the galaxy in completely different observer units. And this is that mass metallicity relation that I was showing before in a slide that showed the theorist units of log z and mass. At the present day population, and the red dots are at a red shift where you would expect the short gamma ray burst to actually occur. So they might be inconsistent with the present day population. They're more consistent with the distribution of galaxies at the redshifts where we have found these hosts. So it's not clear, if you look at the metallicity distribution of short gamma ray burst host galaxies, that there is a bias. Now, is that a problem? Because I just went through this whole song and dance saying there's a massive effect from including low metallicity star formation. Well, two answers. One, any star formation that has ever occurred, I emphasized that repeatedly earlier in the talk, what formed these might have been the low metallicity progenitor gas that occurred earlier in the lifetime of this galaxy. So every galaxy may be a host, and it just that we're primarily seeing them from, we're primarily seeing the remnants of the early phases of evolution. How can we tell? We can't. In fact, even if you had a resolved little tiny chunk of a galaxy, you can look at supernova 1A in nearby galaxies, people do these follow-up observations where they look at nearby chunks of gas within a galaxy and try to reconstruct the star formation history in that little chunk of gas. Let's assume that for some sake we can do that, and you trust that. You'd have to model it for a long period of time to go back to the low metallicity environment that would occur earlier in the universe. And also, these things are kicked. And the galaxy moves around and mixes things a lot. And so if you combine these effects together, the birth metallicity has no correlation with the observed metallicity at all in an evolved galaxy. So the obvious thing is not at all clear that you can do. What other tests can you do? Well, these things would preferentially form in dwarf galaxies. So they'd preferentially be ejected because dwarf galaxies are small. And so you should have a significant fraction in without masses. And you can see that most of the masses are here, but we are finding them down here, which is odd. So the position in this axis says something, because you would preferentially find them down here if they were preferentially at a low metallicity. There's still a mass metallicity correlation, but the distribution in this direction tells you something. And also the fact that we don't find all the short gamma reversible hosts also provides us with a constraint. So we have two constraints that we're trying to impose on our model for allowing low metallicity star formation and also varying all the knots that we usually vary. I don't have a wonderful final thought for you with a revised distribution because we're still tweaking our models and various knobs. But what are the key takeaways? We're going to see something. We're probably going to see a lot. It's very difficult to make this effect go away. It's still consistent with observations of short gamma ray bursts. Third generation detectors will be able to pin it down exquisitely. But until then, we're going to only have the information available from the total number of detectors. That result is still going to be degenerate with some of our other assumptions about how mass transfer works, about how black holes are tipped. And we can't break that degeneracy yet. So at present, Chris and Mikhail are working on improving our binary evolution code, doing a large-scale parameter study. Julian and I are working on this short gamma reverse thing. And obviously, we're all trying to make sure that whatever change we make is still consistent with the vast array of other observations of binaries and single stars in the Milky Way and the universe, the distribution of X-ray binaries in multiple galaxies. This is Tassos, subdwarfs. This is Drew Paulson at Penn State, pulsars, but several people have done. So whatever changes we make, we don't want to break anything. Now, most of the changes we make are specifically, primarily going to affect low metallicity star formation and make high mass black holes. And most of the time, this is not going to break anything over here. But we want to be sure. And with that, I can go on to example slides and answer questions. Thanks.
So I just want to make sure I've got some of the basic bits of the picture. So the binaries are already are born way too far apart to emerge in all of them gravitationally. And is it the case that the way that almost all of them get close is by the common envelope phase?
It's difficult to get them close. Common envelope gets you in a long way. I don't think there's.
How do they get it? One of supernovas and.
Yeah, supernova kicks the other way. You have to push it into a really tight orbit, and you either have to have common envelope or a fortuitous supernova kick. And that's why the rate of formation is so low. You have to have it close, they have to react. So that's a factor of a couple. And then the rare supernova kick to drive you to the other.
And it's
not
known which of those is the
dominant. It depends on the parameters. I can make pretty much if you have a list of binary evolution channels, to make, for example, double homotopic, I think I can make any one of them dominant for different parameter choices. So I've started to forget which one forms which way. Because there are so many and I have so many knobs. And the uncertainties are still really considerable. So this is why I'm really looking forward to having an answer. We'll have an answer. And then we don't have to make up what the mass distribution is. I can just say, all right, I know what the mass distribution is, so I'll measure it. It'll be a line. And then it's just like the CMB, right? The CMB gives you some oscillations. You got to fit that. Look how much information we got out of the CMB. You have this exactly the same problem. This is just in one dimension. We measure a lot of different things for each. Now, admittedly, we only have 100 points or so, so you really have to wait for third-generation detectors to take full advantage of the power of this. But we measure a lot of things, and it's very difficult to fit all of those things simultaneously unless you have room. Very difficult. The error ellipsoids get smaller at a very high power of the number of detections. So each detection will provide us with a very large amount of information that we'll be able to explore. It's much better than just, I mean, the naive answer is the square root of n. If you're just trying to compare the total number of events you see, you've got this, you know, two order of magnitude range of rates of prediction. And observations will pin you to 1 over the square root of the number of detections, relative uncertainty in your detection rate. And you would think, okay, well, that's all the information I have, is the ratio of these two sizes gives you the information content that you've learned. But that's not it, that's not all, because we also get the mass distribution. And the mass distribution is a function. And a function has an infinite number of parameters, in principle. Different parameters have different characteristic sizes, but you know, you get a lot of information out. I mean, it's not exponential convergence, but sometimes it seems like it. You know, you can have 1 over the number of detections to 5. It depends on what part of parameter space you're in. So you can really nail down what the binary evolution model is, because only some binary evolution models will even predict the right masses. It could just be impossible. Now, admittedly, what's the reality is probably there's a couple different channels, maybe globular clusters contribute too. So interpreting this and doing this disentanglement process and not breaking anything is going to be a challenge. This is not going to be for the faint of heart. But there's a huge amount of theoretical work here, big uncertainties. So systematic, very rapidly, will be our dominant problem. But there's a huge amount of information there, and we'll be able to understand things really well very soon.
You used a metallicity that you can measure on the galaxies where you see gamma ray bursts coming from. Can you do more with that? I mean, if you assume that the gamma ray bursts do come from binary, compact binaries,
can you
predict rates and then compare it with your model? And is there a way to not use gravity waves, which we yet don't measure, but something we do measure?
Like the relative proportions. So basically, you're saying the fraction of current dwarf galaxies versus not. Yeah, you can, and that's going to be one of our constraints. Is we have to reproduce the fact.
Okay.
That gamma ray bursts preferentially occur with this distribution relative to the underlying mass distribution of galaxies.
So your current model already comes from that constraint?
We are currently not putting that in because it's hard, because some of them don't have hosts, so do you assume that they all came from kicked out of dwarf galaxies or not? So we don't actually have that in the paper that's going to come out with that Cecilia and I are going to have out soon. It's just going to be about the ambient metallicity surrounding it. So it will primarily be about this axis rather than the distribution here. It's something we can put in, but we're not there yet.
Thanks, Richard, again.